From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense. I'm John Wiener. Later in the show, a question about Hamas. Why did they decide to provoke massive Israeli retaliation now? Hussein Ibish, who writes for The Atlantic, The New York Times, and The Daily Beast, says Hamas had a clear political goal on October 7th to defeat the Palestinian secular nationalists of Fatah and the PLO. He'll explain later in the show. But first, the issues and the language that win for Democrats. Bhaskar Sunkara will comment in a minute.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Which issues work best for Democratic candidates? For that, we turn to Bhaskar Sunkara. He is president of The Nation, founding editor of Jacobin, and author of the book, The Socialist Manifesto. He's also been a columnist for The Guardian U.S. edition. He's written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, lots of other places. Bhaskar, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you report in The Guardian on a new study from the Center for Working Class Politics of all the Democratic candidates for the House and Senate who ran in the 2022 midterm elections, almost 1,000 of them. Researchers for the center read all their websites, records of all their talks to identify the themes, the issues, the words the candidates used. The principal finding was not really surprising. Democratic candidates running on progressive economic issues like building infrastructure, resurrecting manufacturing, creating jobs were more successful than candidates who didn't, especially in white working class districts. Or as you put it in The Guardian, Democrats who attack the rich do better in elections. But you pointed out a more significant and less obvious finding. How often do Democratic candidates attack the rich?
Less than 10% of these Democratic candidates mentioned billionaires, millionaires, Wall Street, or the 1%. So any sort of anti-elite, sort of populist rhetoric.
Next question. What proportion of Democratic candidates came from actual working class backgrounds themselves?
We found that only 2.3% of the candidates we looked at had primarily working class backgrounds before entering politics. So we're, you know, not talking about people who maybe had a few day jobs or whatever else, but people who worked for the majority of their working lives in working class professions, post office workers, teachers. We're not just talking about the manual industrial working class. You know, this was just a small fraction of the Democratic Party candidates.
When it comes to Democrats attacking the rich, there's one historic example of a Democrat who won a lot by attacking the rich. Remind us, please.
Bernie Sanders, obviously, is the classic example that we have on the left of a candidate that had the perfect sort of message discipline, that talked about bread and butter issues, and that simplified all the complexities of the left-wing worldview into a digestible message that resonated with millions of voters, not just Democrats, but independents and even some Republicans.
And if we go back to the 30s, there's a very significant example of a Democrat who attacked the rich.
Of course, and in the article I discuss Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who obviously the cousin of a former president. He's the offspring of two important, powerful, wealthy New York families, but he became the tribune of economic populism in the 1930s. And he figured out that the way to rebuild the country was to mobilize a social base to speak to this emerging and increasingly more important industrial working class that was locked out of politics and to try to represent their interests. And he managed to do it. And obviously he managed to combine some of the most important achievements of our threadbare, welfare state. We got that in the 1930s because I think Roosevelt realized that he not only needed a rhetoric that could win elections, which of course is important, but in order to turn politics into real policy, into real change, he needed a social base.
He had an especially memorable line that you quoted. He was talking about what he called organized money. And he said, they are unanimous in their hatred for me. And what did he say about that?
He said, and I welcome their hatred.
I welcome their hatred. You don't hear that sort of thing from Democrats today, except maybe from Bernie and a few members of the squad.
And to be honest, though, you sometimes do hear it from President Biden. I think President Biden, at his best, at his most vigorous during the campaign, almost like Bernie Sanders, spoke in this older sort of Democratic Party parlance. And it's not that Biden was a progressive. He's always been on the center, even center right of the Democratic Party. But he came from this older generation of Democratic Party politicians. So he runs for his first seat. He becomes a senator in the early 1970s. So he encounters a Democratic Party and he's forced to win over unions. He's forced to win over progressive constituencies that have been sidelined ever since then, the Democratic Party. So I think that he kind of knew how to speak to working class people in a certain way. And he knew how to speak in a way that didn't seem elitist, that didn't seem alienating. He knew how to turn it on at times. And obviously, besides for some really positive things he's done with the National Labor Relations Board appointees and other things, you could say that he didn't follow through with his pledges to organize labor, but you could hear some of that in his rhetoric. You'd hear that he was kind of a weapon against class realignment, at least compared to the neo sort of New Democrat rhetoric of Clinton, compared to these other Democratic politicians who were very keen to lean into just professional class voters in suburbs, and that sort of rhetoric to defeat Trump. You saw some of this in Biden, but the party as a whole, even when they're offering far better policies for working class people, and I have no complaint about saying that I'll gladly vote for 99.9% of Democratic Party candidates when the alternative to them on the ballots is Republicans, but they're still associated with professional class politics, for lack of a better word. They're seen more and more as the party of the Ivy League, the party of vaguely construed elites. And obviously, some of this is unfair.
I just want to look at some of the findings of this study. Candidates spend most of their money on TV. This is, they raise millions of dollars and they spend it on TV ads, which we think don't really succeed in convincing people to vote for them. But the study of the center found that just 30% of TV ads released in 2022 by Democratic candidates in competitive districts focused primarily on bread and butter economic issues. Only 18% of the TV ads said anything at all about jobs. Less than 2% talked about the need for high quality, good paying jobs or unionized jobs. So it's an obvious question here. Why don't more Democratic candidates talk about populist economic issues? Why don't they attack billionaires, millionaires, the 1%?
Yeah, I think that part of it is this idea that Democrats need to cast the widest possible net to resist Trump. And that casting this wide net means talking about Trump's extremism, Republican extremism, their individual qualities as candidates, or issues like abortion, which, of course, are very important issues. But I think there's a lack of a willingness to focus and say that, well, actually, the most important thing that motivates voters is going to be their pocketbooks and is going to be jobs. I think there was an attempt to almost pivot away from the economy and to discuss other issues. And Bernie Sanders himself brought this up in a column in the Guardian that he was attacked for by saying that Democrats can't forget to foreground bread and butter issues, and we can't just run as a party of abortion rights, even though, of course, that is a major positive differentiator between Democrats and Republicans. And if you look at the survey, it's not just that only 18% of ads talked about jobs. The survey said around 5% or a little bit less than 5% of ads invoked billionaires or the rich or Wall Street or big corporations or price gouging. So even fewer of the ads had any sort of class warfare rhetoric. And again, I'm not saying that the Democratic Party should go around and sound overnight like the Socialist Party, but at the very least, invoking this kind of FDR economic populist rhetoric should be common sense for a left of center party that has in its interest to portray itself as a party of the opposition to the establishment.
I was sort of surprised to see that so few of the Democratic TV ads talked about jobs, because I thought every candidate talks about jobs, has jobs on their website. Trump talks about jobs. So it's not just that you should talk about jobs, it's how you propose to create jobs. And that's where the big difference is that Democrats need to emphasize.
Part of it is every candidate, of course, will mention jobs in maybe a stump speech on occasion, or will have a little section on their site. It'll be part of their platform. A lot of these candidates stand for very good things. Many of them stand for things like the PRO Act that could really positively transform American labor. But I think this is where we understand what candidates are willing to foreground, what they want to make their candidacy about as a whole. And again, you're seeing that jobs are something that are mentioned, but isn't what Democrats wanted to run on in 2022. And of course, they made some gains in 2022. So they might be learning some of the wrong lessons in the lead up to this coming presidential election.
And of course, when Republicans talk about creating jobs, they say tax cuts are the best way to create jobs. We don't think that's right.
Yes, of course. Republicans have managed to combine this anti-establishment rhetoric, often framed as anti-woke rhetoric, and this working class affect, and obviously tied it to anti-working class politics, to the politics of redistribution from the poor to the rich. But that's all the more reason why Democrats need to respond with their own fire. People want an outlet for some of their frustrations. And if we don't correctly identify millionaires and billionaires as that outlet for that frustration, it's going to naturally fall to racial minorities and immigrants and all the other scapegoats that the Republican right will conjure.
There was one other thing that was not highlighted in either the report that you cited or in your piece, which I thought was also pretty significant. There are dozens of topics that millions of Americans think define today's Democratic Party. Defund the police, open borders. How many Democratic candidates did your study find said anything about defunding the police or open borders?
Yeah, so our study found that very few Democrats actually were running on this kind of, for lack of a better word, you know, woke, or if you want to call it progressive cultural rhetoric terms, very, very few. I don't have the exact figures around me. As far as I know, the defund the police amount was zero, and open borders is pretty close to zero. Many more candidates, almost all of them, ran on abortion, and there was other mentions of LGBT issues and support for undocumented immigrants and their rights. But in general, candidates didn't really campaign on polarizing cultural rhetoric.
Yeah, so then the big question is, how have the Democrats become so closely identified with defund the police and open the borders?
One, there was a period where we have to be honest that at least when it comes to defund the police, this was a demand that was embraced in various forms by certain progressive candidates. And I personally don't think it was a positive response to a real crisis of not only police violence, but also crises of crime and insecurity that we have in the country. You know, I don't think the solution is a carceral solution, but I think it kind of smacked as a sort of denialism that America can be a normal, well-functioning, social democratic society in which we have accountable police that are well-trained and well-funded, but also don't commit violence against innocent people. And we could have a social safety net that helps create the sort of environment and good jobs, create the environments in which ordinary people don't fall victim to crime and can in confidence be in the public sphere. So I think, first of all, it's worth acknowledging that this really did happen. I think a lot of Democrats embrace this rhetoric, at least a strong minority of them embrace this rhetoric.
And that was, yeah, especially in city council races. I know in Minneapolis, this was a big issue. In LA, there were three city council candidates who ran on a variety of defund the police. I don't think it was more than about 5% of candidates for the House or the Senate.
Yeah, I think by the time that the races came around in 2020, I think the moment had changed. I don't have the figures in front of me. I would guess that maybe 10, 15%, again, this is a guess, might have embraced the rhetoric at one point or the other in the summer of 2020. This is all to say that even though the study found that no one's running on it in 2022, doesn't mean that this was all conjured as a right-wing lie. And there are people who earnestly believe in defunding the police. I don't use the rhetoric of open borders, but I'm in favor of really liberalizing our immigration regime, you know, with checks and processing at the border, but a much more radical liberalization than I think a lot of Americans today would be comfortable with. But I think the association wasn't conjured out of anywhere. I think one of the reasons why it's sticking is because Republicans, of course, have found that that's one place where Democrats are particularly vulnerable. But I think also the Democrats haven't really switched the narrative by saying, no, what defines me as a Democrat is about my belief that organized money, to use the language you summoned before from FDR, that organized money shouldn't run government, that government needs to be run by the people in a democratic way. And that means finding ways to control the wealth and power of billionaires and large corporations. I think that's the main thing that defines a Democrat. Along with that comes other egalitarian priorities, like, for example, our quest for racial justice, like our quest for reproductive rights for women and so on. But I think that without this clarity, it becomes very easy for the right to redefine what it means to be a progressive in America, or even more broadly, what it means to be a Democrat in America.
Bhaskar Sunkara. His article, Democrats Who Attack the Rich Do Better in Elections, co-authored by Jared Abbott, appeared in The Guardian. Thank you, Bhaskar.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
We have a question about Hamas. Why did they decide to provoke a massive Israeli response now? For comment, we turn to Hussein Ibish. He's a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. He's written for The Atlantic, The Daily Beast, The New Republic, and The New York Times, and he's appeared widely on the network news shows. Hussein Ibish, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, John. Thank you.
A near universal assumption is that Hamas viewed its surprise attack on October 7th as the opening to another phase in a long-term war against Israel. You say there's some truth to that, but there's a different reason that explains why they did it now. Please explain.
Of course, Hamas does see itself in a long-term war with Israel, although that's, you know, the contours of that are to be defined over time. But I think the reason for the October 7 attack, the timing of it, the nature of it, and virtually all of its specific contours and attributes were shaped not by the Palestinian-Israeli relationship or the Hamas-Israeli relationship, but rather by internal Palestinian power struggle, by internal Palestinian power dynamics, and a kind of a partisan competition between Hamas and the secular nationalists in Fatah. Hamas was founded in 1987 during the crucible of the First Intifada, the first uprising by ordinary Palestinians against Israeli military rule, in where there was a kind of vacuum of leadership. And at the time, it was left-wing grassroots committees that were directing the uprising. And then the PLO, which was kind of the secular nationalist organization, began to claw back control of the movement. But there was an opening, and the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza founded Hamas with the founding directive of trying to marginalize the secular nationalists, take over the national movement, and make the Palestinian cause in the long run an Islamist one run by them. And that has never changed. They've made a lot of progress over the decades in getting there, but they still don't have control of the national movement. They are in control of Gaza, but not of Area A in the West Bank, which is the sort of prime real estate under Palestinian control. And more importantly, they don't control or even belong to the PLO.
The opinion polls show that this Hamas strategy worked for a while after October 7th, to dramatically increase support for Hamas among Palestinians, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, and to weaken Hamas's rivals, as you have said, Fatah and the Palestinian Authority. But you say things are changing now in this power struggle within the Palestinian movement. You wrote recently about what you called a mood shift among Palestinians. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think you are starting to see a mood shift, and there are a number of pieces of evidence for it. One is there's a lot more grumbling coming out of Gaza about Hamas, about what did they do to us, about what on earth did they mean by this attack? How could they play with our lives like that? And I think after October 7, it was a sentiment that got buried both in terms of public opinion on the ground and in terms of what the Fatah leaders were, like Mahmoud Abbas and others, were willing to say about Hamas, underneath the kind of shared outrage at Israel's behavior in Gaza and a kind of rally around the flag and national solidarity and all of that. But over time, what's happened is, I think the question has started to be raised, about what did Hamas think it was doing? Now, that's a question that will become almost inevitable and in a very dangerous way for Hamas if Israel were to leave Gaza anytime in the near term. But as long as Israel's there, it does sort of suppress the impulse to ask the question. Nonetheless, the question is being asked more and more, and you can see it in the kind of statements that are getting out into the media, and certainly in the Fatah response to Hamas's criticisms.
Yes, you quote Fatah in your piece in The Daily Beast, saying that Hamas was responsible for, quote, a Nakba that is more severe than the 1948 Nakba. That sounds pretty strong.
It's the strongest thing you can say in Palestinian national politics. I mean, the Nakba 48 represents the destruction of Palestine as a society. I mean, before the 1947-48 war, there was a Palestinian society, a country in a fledgling country. It was there. It was coming into being. And at the end of the war, it was gone. And most of the Palestinians were outside of historical Palestine and were refugees, and the national movement was decimated for decades. So if you say this is a Nakba, a calamity, worse than the calamity of 48, you're saying it's worse than the worst. It's like saying worse than the Holocaust among Jews. And I think what you point to there is the fact that, he got 35,000 people killed in a few months. And that's a number that is off the charts in terms of dead Palestinians. So it's not a silly thing to say. It's just a very strong thing to say.
And while a million Palestinians in Gaza are homeless, Fatah said Hamas leaders now, quote, live a life of luxury in seven-star hotels, a reference to Qatar, where the Hamas leadership lives now. That's on a different register, but still a very powerful point.
It's a powerful point. I mean, the Hamas Politburo was expelled from Gaza, went to Syria, and then they fled Syria in 2012 during the Arab Spring uprisings and ended up in Qatar. And they've been there living a life of relative luxury. And it's in stark contrast to the kind of life of martyrdom and sacrifice, struggle, and blood, toil, and tears that they prescribe to ordinary people. Now, there's a contrast here, which is the leadership on the ground in Gaza. Yahya Sinwar, the political and sort of maximum Hamas leader, and Mohammed Daif, the paramilitary leader, who are presumably in tunnels underground underneath Khan Yunis or underneath southern Gaza somewhere. And they don't live lives of luxury. But the former Politburo or the Politburo leaders, who are now the diplomats of Qatar, do. And it's a way of jabbing at them for sure. And it's not false.
We talked earlier about the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, which Hamas would like to control. How important is the PLO to the Palestinian cause internationally?
Yeah, so this is the thing people need to understand. The PLO's diplomatic standing and global presence is the crown jewel in the Palestinian sort of hat, coronet, whatever they've created since 1967 and the rejuvenation of the Palestinian national movement under Arafat and beyond. The main thing that the Palestinians have built that Israel can't take away from them is exactly the international role and standing and presence of the PLO. So we've got 130 missions around the world, embassies, other missions everywhere, and non-member observer state status in the UN General Assembly and membership in countless multinational and multilateral organizations, from UNICEF to the WHO to, all kinds of things. And whoever gets up to speak for the Palestinians in an international forum, whether it's the Arab League, at the UN, in any of these organizations, at embassies all over the world, is going to be a PLO representative. And Hamas has never been a part of the PLO. It's never participated in the PLO. And until Hamas gains control over that international voice, it can't really pretend to speak for the Palestinians. At the same time, Hamas not being part of the PLO and not being in sync with Fatah is a problem for the Palestinians, because you have this big faction that's kind of outside the whale, and the Israelis take advantage of it a lot. But it's still the case that Hamas needs to claw that international voice away from their secular rivals.
And what exactly was Hamas's situation on the eve of October 7th? Where did they stand at that point in their rivalry with Fatah?
They were in a really bad situation, actually. And I think people who followed the Middle East closely knew how dire their situation was. But I think a lot of us, or very few of us, knew what they were going to do, or had a sense that they were going to lash out. But yeah, they were in big trouble. First of all, I think Gaza had turned more and more into a kind of a quagmire for them rather than a launching pad. They seemed to be stuck there, just kind of bogged down in Gaza, couldn't get back into the West Bank, and just kind of trapped in this little sort of hole in Gaza. They were losing support from their international backers, from Turkey and from Qatar. Both of them were saying, you got to do more for yourself. The Turks kind of pulling away from them diplomatically. The Qataris kind of suggesting that they weren't interested in continuing to pay the bills for Hamas on an ongoing basis. And then also Hamas was losing its brand, because Hamas's competitive advantage against the PLO, the PA, and Fatah has been armed struggle. Because since 1993, the PLO, the PA, and Fatah have staked everything on negotiating a two-state agreement with Israel, whereas Hamas continues to use the rhetoric, if not the practice, always of armed struggle. And there are these youth groups that have cropped up in the West Bank, in the old city of Nablus, the Lion's Den, in the Jenin refugee camp, the Jenin Brigades, and others. Young men with guns doing what young men with guns do, and certainly confronting Israeli occupation soldiers and armed settlers. And so they were becoming the vanguard of the confrontation with armed Israelis, whether it was armed Israeli soldiers or armed Israeli settlers. And so Hamas was even losing their one main brand, which was armed struggle. So they were in big trouble. And I think they really felt that something needed to be done. The worst thing was they could see that whatever benefits Palestinians were going to get, no matter how limited, from a U.S.-Israeli-Saudi agreement, were all going to go to Fatah in the West Bank. And it was going to be money from Saudi Arabia. It was going to be some political goodies for the PA, maybe even some additional standing for the PLO. And they just couldn't afford it. The Palestinian national scene was very evenly divided, a delicate equilibrium. And I think a Saudi American finger was going to come down on the scale on the other side of the equilibrium from Hamas. And they thought it's got to be stopped. And they did stop it. And I think that was a very key reason why they acted when they did.
So, the United States in all this, what should be the political goal of the United States in of Israel if they seriously want to defeat Hamas?
Well, if they want to defeat Hamas, they need to understand what Hamas' political goal is and recognize that Hamas' political goal is internal to the Palestinian national movement. It's not primarily to do with Israel, though eventually it may be. It's not mainly about Iran and the Saudi-Israeli thing as a regional issue, but rather about the competition for power between Palestinian Islamists and Palestinian secularists. And that's where the name of the game really is. If you want to defeat Hamas and thwart Hamas and answer October 7 on its own terms, it's not enough to deal Hamas blows from the outside. You've got to support their rivals. Otherwise, it won't be a defeat for them. Otherwise, it'll be a matter of them kind of like brazening it out and toughing it out and then emerging, waving the bloody shirt, which is the ultimate banner of power and victory, and saying, look, we are the national movement. We are the right ones. You know, we are the true people. These guys in the West Bank aren't doing anything. They're ridiculous. We are fighting Israeli occupation forces every day for control of Palestinian land. in Gaza. We're dying, we're killing, we're doing everything that men do in a freedom struggle, and the others aren't. And that's because we are the national movement, and we should be the representatives internationally as well. And we are really the only ones who stand for the people. And that's what they want to say. And so to deny them that, you've got to bolster the others. There's no other way. The bottom line is, if you want to defeat Hamas, you have got to strengthen the PLO, the PA, and Fatah. There's no other way. Otherwise, ultimately, Hamas will win.
The only way to truly defeat Hamas is to strengthen the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, and Fatah. That's the conclusion of Hussein Ibish. He wrote about it for The Daily Beast. Hussein Ibish, you've convinced me. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, John. Anytime.
Start Making Sense, a podcast from The Nation magazine, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded in Los Angeles at our Blythe Avenue studios. Renee Reynolds is our associate producer. Alan Minsky is our producer. Ludwig Hurtado is our executive producer. D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation. Bhaskar Sunkara is president of The Nation. And Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com. And subscribe to Start Making Sense on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.